need a little harmony. Who take the high part? It takes the worried man to sing the worried song. It takes a worried man to sing the worried song. It takes a worried man. If you're gonna sing high or sing low, vice versa, and here we go. It takes a worried man to sing a worried song. It takes a worried man to sing a worried song. I said it takes a worried man to sing a worried song. A worried man. Across the river, and I lay down to sleep. I went across the river, and I lay down to sleep. I went across the river, and I lay down to sleep. When I woke up, I had shackles on my feet. I said it takes a worried man. You said. Long, the gal I love.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Is a Bright Future for Healthcare Possible? Dr. Donald Berwick, who studies management of healthcare systems to improve trade-offs among quality, safety, and costs, has concluded that any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, civilized, and humane must be redistributional of wealth from the richer among us to the poor and the less fortunate.
Another area of waste, innovations that don't help. The password for the year, I think the password for the decade, seems to be innovation. That's encouraging. All improvement is change. On the other hand, not all change is improvement, and not all innovations help. In fact, at this stage in healthcare, I have a feeling that many, maybe most, of the changes in equipment, in products and services that we're labeling innovations may not help. Now, remember, I'm not saying that they have a high positive marginal cost effectiveness, that they do help a little, but they cost a lot. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a different social problem. I'm talking about innovations that have negative marginal cost effectiveness, where you add the innovation, you get worse care at higher cost. I talked this year at a large convention with 6,000 clinicians in it, and they brought me to their exhibit hall. There were 6,000 exhibitors, one-to-one, selling fiber optic this and robotic that and ceramic this and titanium that and disposable everything. And I am sure that in that acreage of innovations, there are very few miracles. There are things that will really help patients, but every instinct I have tells me that much of what is being offered as innovation in healthcare isn't. It isn't helpful. It will add complexity, it will add risk, and it will add downstream opportunity costs. And public policy is not equipped to deal with this. It doesn't have the capacity. The statutory authorities in Medicare and Medicaid to demand evidence, to inform clinicians, to tie all that to payment, they're weak or non-existent authorities. There's an important counterexample to take note of. In the Affordable Care Act, there's a provision that Medicare has to cover any clinical preventive services that are scored A or B, that is based on evidence by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. That has been attacked as government-run health care. With very few exceptions, the FDA and CMS cannot consider comparative cost effectiveness in any of its findings. The mechanisms for coverage determination in Medicare are few. They're administratively starved. And market forces just haven't shown the capacity yet to distinguish between productive innovation and unproductive. Final category under waste is I call the boundaries of guilds. Healthcare has very proud professions. We have very strong guilds. And I think that they deserve our respect. They deserve our trust in the first instance. We should trust their generosity and their ethics. But the guilds do need to change. For example, I would call upon them not to oppose but to support new models of care, models that expand roles for non-physicians, models that give new power, new capacity to patients and families, models that boldly use modern telemedicine and other technologies. Let me show you three quick examples. This is a photo of the installation of the ECHO project in New Mexico. The ECHO project was developed and is now led by Dr. Sanjeev Arora. Dr. Arora is a liver specialist. He's a specialist in hepatitis C, for which, prior to his work, if you wanted to be cured of hepatitis C, which is very complex to do but can be done, you have to go to the University Medical Center. Not with Dr. Arora. With the ECHO project, he's projecting capacity. He's teaching primary care nurses and doctors all over the state of New Mexico to properly care for hepatitis C without any referral to the academic medical center. And his results are the same or better in the telemedicine-supported care as they would be if the same patients were to get to the University Medical Center, projecting knowledge. Here's a wonderful example of a technology that helps. It's the Afghan card. I saw patients in Alaska. I lived in Alaska for a year and a half when my wife moved there on a sabbatical. I moved there and spent some time in the Indian Health Service seeing patients in little tiny Alaska villages flying to the village to see kids that were stacked up for the month by the community health aid. Well, no longer. Now the Afghan cart, a cart about the size of the podium I'm speaking from, exists. It was developed under a Department of Commerce grant. This cart sits in the little village clinic in Scammon Bay or Hooper Bay. Patients get attached to it. It collects biometric information, EKG, otoscope, ophthalmoscope, sphygmomanometer, blood pressure, and it sends all that information to Anchorage where the Afghan team does the care remotely. They've reduced travel 70%. They've reduced waiting times for ENT consultations to 24 hours all over the state of Alaska, which is big, and the return on investment is 10.54 to 1. This is another innovation. This is innovation in workforce, the Dental Health Aid Therapy Program in Alaska. This is a program of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the University of Washington, and it's training young people, even high school graduates, in an 18-month or two-year course to provide complete dental care to people out in those little villages. Not dentists. They don't need the dentists. They fly out there, they open this portable workstation and fill cavities, do dental prophylaxis. They can meet the needs. The entire needs of rural Alaska in the native system can be met with 70 DHAT therapists, without the need for a dentist. Legacy payment rules, the RBRVS payment scheme, which some of you will know, coding systems, these rules do not encourage changes like this. They make changes harder, especially rules on scope of practice are making change hard. We need the help of the guilds. We don't need their opposition. We need them to help recreate roles and capacities in care. Some are helping, but others are really fighting this, and I think it's time to stop that. I urge flexibility, guided by evidence, instead of resisting new roles, new technologies, broaden the scope of practice. I think we should be asking with optimism how to make these continually safer, more reliable, more effective. Don't say no, say how. The third major category of monsters are priorities, and I want to mention a few of these, and then I'll wrap up. The first is defending the poor. I often share a quotation from Senator Hubert Humphrey. It's engraved on the wall of the building where I worked for a year and a half, a CMS administrator, the Hubert Humphrey Building, and he said this at the speech he gave at the dedication of the building in 1977. Humphrey said, "The moral test of government is how it treats those in the dawn of life, the children, those in the twilight of life, the aged, and those in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." At this time, it's a hard sell in the public arena. I'm not exactly sure why this moral test is not more explicitly embraced. There's much more talk about helping the middle class. That's also important. The middle class is crucial. I totally agree with the agenda that will help the middle class, jobs, infrastructure, tax relief, and so on. But I'm losing sleep about Hubert Humphrey's moral test. We are at risk of failing it. The social safety net is vulnerable. The will to protect the poor needs constant reinforcement from civil society. Government will not do it without that fuel. I think we need continued reinforcement of a premise in our country. That premise is that health care is a human right, period. You remember, our international colleagues are giving care at something like half of U.S. costs. How do they do that? If we understood that, we would have available more to assure health care is a human right. Another topic is end-of-life care or in palliative care. The very cruel rhetoric about death panels took end-of-life care, frankly, off the political table at just the time that an aging population, an entirely new profile of chronic illness demands the opposite. Death panels, of course, are hogwash. They're pure figments of warped imagination and of irresponsible leaders who are willing to frighten vulnerable people in the service of selfish political gain. But the rules in the Washington, at the moment, they still favor never officially mentioning end-of-life care or palliative care or advanced directives. That is a tragic silence, and it has to stop. Try joining the Conversation Project started at IHI, conversationproject.org. Study La Crosse, Wisconsin, which has taken this on as a community. We need civil society to speak up everywhere about the possibility of far, far better care in advanced life and palliation. The next topic is prevention. The IHI has the triple aim, better care, better health, lower cost. The runt of the litter is better health. The cathedrals of modern healthcare, hospitals, they cure disease, but they do not prevent disease. And mostly they can't prevent it because they're nowhere near the changeable causes. That's the bridge in the wrong place. Behavioral choices, nutrition, inequity, injustice, pollution. Prevention doesn't have any cathedrals. And as a result, there's a massive misallocation of resources. A Martian visitor, I think, would call it insane. We haven't built sufficient institutional structures for prevention. I saw a thrilling counterexample of this, by the way, recently in September. I was in New Zealand, and I was there for the launch by the new cabinet-level commission for children. New Zealand has a cabinet-level official just for kids. And he issued the plan for ending childhood poverty in New Zealand. It's a comprehensive plan. It's cross-sectoral. It involves jobs and housing, healthcare, education, infrastructure. It's prevention in a full form. If they stick with it, it's going to work. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the prevention fund that was established under the Affordable Care Act is under attack. There are serious proposals in Congress to cut the CDC budget in half. We need the opposite. We need groundbreaking, habit-breaking redesign of our nation's approach to the prevention of illness and the preservation of health. We have the rhetoric. We have a national prevention strategy, but we need the will. And finally, a fourth category, a barrier. It's a single entry. It's a singleton. It has to do with a technical problem, but it has to do with the transition of businesses. I want to call your attention to one of the finest innovations in American healthcare that I've ever seen. It's recent. It's the NUCA care system for Alaska Natives in Anchorage, Alaska. It's run by the South Central Foundation, the tribal corporation. In 2009, for this work, they won the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. NUCA is a team-based, population-minded, prevention-oriented total care system. It's built on principles of total cooperation. This picture you're looking at is a NUCA office, and you're seeing a doctor, a nurse, a pharmacist, a behaviorist, a social worker. They all work together all the time, completely team-based care. Look at the NUCA results. NUCA, in the 6 or 7 years after it started, drove emergency department visits down by 50%, primary care visits down by 20%, hospital bed days down by 53%, specialty visits down by 65%, and they all, at the time, were achieving the highest quality scores and the highest satisfaction they'd ever seen among staff and patients. Results like this, imagine this result at national scale, it would totally solve the U.S. healthcare problem without harming a single patient. On the contrary, people would be better off. But I'll tell you, a normal hospital CEO or specialist who saw these results would not feel elated. She would feel heartburn. The hospital CEO would be at risk of being fired by the board as revenues fell.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
The problem isn't the destination. The destination is a better place, lower cost, higher quality care. It's the transition that's the problem, the stranded capital, the misaligned workforce, the business cycle management, the public belief that confuses volume and technology with healing and with solace. I think U.S. healthcare executives and boards are starting to get it, but they're very uncomfortable, and very few of them know how to navigate through this transition, and they are very worried. As a result, the adaptations of American hospitals to the new context, the context in which it's better to have an empty bed than a full bed, which is the way we should want it, is maladaptive. Their foundation remains revenue-driven models, last-man-standing business models. These can't not work for American communities in the long run. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Voldemort. 11 monsters. They would like to scare us into silence. Nathaniel is going to leave his monsters behind, and we're going to have to do that too. The improvement movement can celebrate 3 decades of the growing successes, case by case, process by process. That's terrific. But these monsters, I'll give you a quote. They roar their terrible roars, they gnash their terrible teeth, they roll their terrible eyes, and they show their terrible claws. That's from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. Nathaniel knows this by heart. I do too. And we love the part where the monsters say to Max, "Oh, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so." And Max says, "No." And that's our job, too. We have to say, "No." And here's what civil society is going to need to do, loudly, constantly, unafraid, to reassert the kind of leadership we need. First, reaffirm confidence in science. Confidence in science is the basis for helping and cure. Second, learn. Learn unapologetically, not just within nations, but among nations. Third, learn to learn in complex systems, systems that defy classical experiments, but nonetheless teach us enormous amounts. They're rich in lessons. Fourth, we have to declare that overtreatment is widespread in healthcare, that it does not help patients, and that we will stop it. Fifth, we have to neither engage in nor tolerate in silence profiteering, even if legal, that harms patients and degrades public trust. Sixth, we have to require that innovations show their worth before they spread. Seventh, we have to lead the professional guilds to embrace change. They need to welcome widening scopes of practice, and they do need to participate wholeheartedly in the redesign of healthcare as a system. Eighth, we have to defend the poor, the children, the aged, the people in the dawn and the shadows and the twilight of life. We must pass the moral test. Ninth, we have to revolutionize care approaching the end of life, palliative care. We have to assure human dignity and comfort and healing, the healing presence of loved ones and the community. Tenth, we need to honor prevention, not in rhetoric, but in fact. And 11th, we will need to develop and test and share and spread pragmatic models for healthcare organizations to make the transition from volume-based business models where the best bed is a full bed to integrated care directed at the triple aim where the best bed is an empty bed. This isn't small stuff. This brings those of myself and colleagues in the improvement movement fully into contact with politics and with the pressures of systemic change. That is not a place I thought I would be. But I think we need to be there. The bridge to the future is not the bridge of the past. Nathaniel is at a threshold. He will soon leave behind the monsters in his mind who roar their terrible roars and gnash their terrible teeth. But leaving behind the beasts he imagines, he will, of course, come face to face with the orcs and the ogres of the real world. If he were to choose a life of service, as we in healthcare have chosen, then his role and his mission will be to pull their fangs. Ours, our orcs, our ogres, the misuse of knowledge, the wages of waste, the tragedy of priorities that have been misplaced. They have the power of the past on their side, and it will take power to fight power, and it will take courage to change course. Thank you.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Donald Berwick, Is a Bright Future for Healthcare Possible? Dr. Berwick is a former president and CEO of the Institute of Healthcare Improvement, among other things. So now it's time for Q&A. That's the first one.
Good evening. I'm Claire Brindis, and thank you so much for your remarks. I'm at the University of California, San Francisco. And I was wondering if you could comment on the role of consumers. We've talked a lot about patient-centeredness in terms of doctor to nurse or nurse practitioner and patient. But creating this 11-point monster elimination plan is going to really require a tremendous mobilization of consumers everywhere. And can you make some remarks about the role of consumers at the systems level?
Sure, Claire. It's nice to see you. The role of an informed public is crucial in the kind of changes we're talking about. A misinformed public that's on its heels, frightened that things are going to be taken away, not understanding how good care can be, having embraced what they've been taught, which is that more is always better, that can't help. They'll reinforce a status quo that's not serving them well. So we have a pretty big job here, which is to bring along a public that I think wants to trust us in healthcare into a new era. If we were able to unite on the healthcare side, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, clinicians of all types, hospital managers and others, and explain this consistently with a voice that is confident and patient, I think the public will join us. They're better off. You're better off in a coordinated, health-oriented system that asks questions first about the usefulness of what's done. So we often talk about the public, but we have to reach out to them now in a way that they have not been reached out to before. And meanwhile, the status quo noises are very loud. So I'm hopeful, Cara, I really am. My own view is that this is best tackled locally, that I think to expect this from Washington or even maybe from a state capital is probably less realistic, less possible than that San Diego or Omaha or San Francisco could pick it up and say we're going to be the place where health goes to the center. And I think it's possible. The public is plenty smart. Yes.
Dr. Berwick, my name is Michael Pierce. I have a question about acupuncture and reimbursement for that. Because, for example, I've had two things myself where I went to a traditional orthopedist and was diagnosed with a torn labrum in my shoulder. And I couldn't raise my arm much higher than this. I couldn't go across my chest. And then I was scheduled for surgery. And before I went to my acupuncturist. And he said, oh, you have frozen shoulder and you have inflammation, and now I can raise my arm there, I can put my arm like that. Similarly, I was treated for nerve problem in my leg and was given by Western medicine person I was given a they put some drug in your back and they numb your your nerve, and the acupuncturist cured that as well. But insurance companies don't reimburse for that, and it costs a lot less. And I'm curious your perspective on that.
Remember, we've built a healthcare system, that bridge that I showed you, that first bridge, on a technocracy where procedures and invasions and things one does to a person are the way the system's organized. That's where the money goes. That's where the attention is. Supportive therapies, behavioral therapies, mental health care, counseling, things oriented toward healthy lifestyle, these have been marginalized in the payment and system. Now, acupuncture may better fall in that long list of other ways to help people than the usual ways to do it. That's why the payment system is as it is. What I would say is, first, we need to rebalance a care system that really is much more organized around helping people understand how to make themselves healthy. It isn't so organized around procedures all the time, would be less wasteful, there'd be less overuse, and probably a more informed public and patient. With respect to the specific case of acupuncture, my only plea is, as we widen our search for things that help, these should be subjected to the same kinds of rigor, of understanding, of evaluation, as we would for a pill or a piece of surgery, which have largely escaped that kind of rigor. So I'm all for thinking harder about ways that helping can occur, ways that have developed outside our own culture, as long as we're committed to evaluation of the proper type for those procedures.
Mixing up the medicine, I'm on the pavement, thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out laid off, says he's got a bad cough. did something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie calls Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA, look out, kid, don't matter what you did. But walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get bought, get back, ride frail, get jail, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters. Girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool, don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meters. Oh, get born, keep warm, short pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get blessed. Try to be success, please her, please him. Buy gifts, don't steal, don't live. 20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift. Look out, kid, they keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals and try to forge the scandal. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work cause the vandals took the handle.
And now for something completely different.